I see weeds everywhere I go. I can't stop seeing weeds. Walking down the street, I'm just mentally naming weeds, mentally pulling them out. And every weed's different. We've got lantana, we've got madeira, we've got senna, all the big names in the weeds. It's a battle of the weeds here, isn't it?
Today seems like as good a day as any to get a bit of weeding done. My name's Anne Jones, and welcome to Off Track on RN. This program is about a group of people who go out weeding. They're caring for the land, but with a bit of a difference. It's called floating land care. It's like normal land care, lots of weeding, lots of clearing and revegetating. But these conservation volunteers are taken to an isolated area that no one else can access. That is, unless they have an oyster punt as well. We're on the Hawkesbury River, and the owner of the punt is Rob Moxham.
And the life jackets are up the front, but I don't anticipate. It's too cool to go for a swim, I think.
It's an aluminium oyster punt, and it's about 10.5 foot wide, and it'll quite comfortably carry 5 or 6 ton. And it's flat bottom, and only takes about 2 inches of water to float in. It's got a 225 horse Honda on the back, because our leases are a long way away, so you need to get there pretty quick. And we all have four strokes now, you know, they're much more friendly on the river. And it's a very good thing for doing this job too, because, you know, you can put 20 volunteers in it quite comfortably, and hardly put the thing down in the water and come into shallow water and get into these places which are pretty inaccessible. I mean, there's no road coming in here. We've got to come in by water, and we've got to watch the tides, and something which only needs a puddle of water to float in, that's the best thing to use.
Rebecca Moy works with Greater Sydney Local Land Services, and she organises the floating land care.
So, welcome again, everyone. I'm just going to let you know a little bit about floating land care for those that haven't been before. I know there's quite a few regulars, which is great, and it's always good to have everyone come back that's been before. So floating land care is basically about taking volunteers onto the Hawkesbury River along the estuary and visiting sites that you can only get to by boat, which is pretty exciting. It's a little bit different to a general bush care activity where you turn up at the maybe a site at the back of someone's property or a local reserve owned by the council. So mostly we go to national park sites that are along the river, a combination of bush regeneration and also some litter collection, so marine debris cleanups. But we've probably had at least 300 volunteers come along over the past almost 2 years now, and floating land care's got another 6 months to go. Hopefully we can go a little bit longer with a bit of corporate sponsorship and push it into 2015. So thanks to everyone for coming again today, and I might pass you over to Tegan.
My name's Tegan Burton, and I'm a ranger with the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service. I've been fortunate enough to be the ranger for Moogamara Nature Reserve since 2001. It's this and another park I look after, Marimara National Park, for me, are the absolute jewels of Sydney, certainly of northern Sydney, so it's a huge benefit to be able to help look after them for such a long period. So Moogamara Nature Reserve, the core part of the reserve was in fact a crown lease from the 1930s held by a fellow called John Tipper, who, although it was a crown lease, which people often take to then run cattle or grow fruit trees, he set it up as a area for natural conservation. It was called Moogamara Sanctuary. So it's had that history for, you know, since the 1930s. That was the core area, and then slowly it came across to national parks when national parks were set up in 1967, and then slowly other parts of the reserve have been added. So, for example, the site we're on now is an old house site, which I think was added in the 70s, but until then it was private freehold land and a residence. So every little bit has its own kind of bit of history to it.
When you first saw this particular site, what was it like?
Yeah, it's an old house site, and it's not easily accessible. You can only get here by water, and it's not had a wharf since the 80s, so you can in fact only get here by water on a high tide in the right boat. So when we first did land here, and it was because the local river community had brought it to our attention, it was just an absolute wall of old garden escapes, a wall of agave, big prickly agaves, and up in the background some lantana and some pampas that you could just see from the water.
So that was quite some time ago. What sort of work have you done between then and now?
So it's had a bit of a different strategy than what we often use. So normally with bush care, you'd kind of start from the really good bush and then just slowly chip away into those really heavily infested areas. But for this site, we in fact had the local community come and do a massive clear out of all the agave and the lantana. It was in fact bringing a little mini excavator over. Huge thanks to the oyster farmers who did way more than what was ever expected or anticipated in doing all that clearing. We then had a really clear, exposed site which needed a lot more assistance to regenerate. So rather than just kind of let it to do its own thing, we put down a whole lot of weed matting, and we did some planting of mostly grasses and a few shrubs, but to try and get the grasses to take hold first. And then we've just been coming back now and trying to maintain those areas, keep the weeds away from the plantings to give them the best chance.
So when was the last time you came out here?
I think it would have been about 12 months ago, unfortunately.
And what's your impression of the site, how it's going?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, when we first got off the boat and, you know, you're kind of looking at this big wall of ground cover weeds, particularly biotins and some other old garden succulents, and thought, oh no, this is just going so far backwards. But in fact, once we came up into the main part of the site and where we've been doing all the planting, it's actually going really well. I mean, a lot of the plants have taken, even though they've had hardly any attention. They didn't get any water after they went in or anything like that. And the weeds that are coming up in between are quite small, just, some small biotins and small lantana that's quite achievable. So I think it's actually going really well.
You referred various times then to the river community. Just who are you speaking about?
There's a few river foreshore communities, that in the past had full-time residents and are now slowly becoming more and more kind of weekenders, but still a few full-time residents. And so just upstream from us is a small community called Milson's Passage, and around the corner is another small community called Pete's Bite and Sunny Corner, and Bar Point is on the other side of the river. And it doesn't matter whether they're on the southern side of the river, which is one LGA, or the north side, which is another LGA. They just really identify with the river itself, and so they're quite passionate about it. Here we work a lot with the oyster farmers, and they've been a really kind of motivated part of that community. I think people often think of farmers generally, and oyster farmers are farmers as well, in terms of, you know, being primary producers. But in fact, and particularly when it's an industry that is so connected to the natural environment, they just know how the river's behaving, you know, when it's healthy, when it's not healthy, and especially when it's been families, you know, that have been here for generations and generations, like the local oyster families. They're really connected with this area and they're really passionate, and so they kind of help keep us motivated in terms of focusing on the river.
Rob Moxon. I've lived here all my life and grown up in Brooklyn. I'm a fourth generation oyster farmer, and hopefully we're trying to help to make sure there's a fifth generation, I suppose.
Have you been to this particular site before?
Yeah, so I started this site cleaning up in about 2005. There was an old house site here. Probably 30 years prior, it was vacated. There was old big gardens here and things like that, and the lantana got away over the last 20 or 25 years. And me and a couple of oyster farmers got up here and cleaned up the bulk of it, and we've been back several times since just to do follow-up work, because all the exotic weeds and that, they're pretty hard to, you've got to have follow-up or it'll just end up like it was 20 years ago.
And what's your impression of the site when we arrived today?
Oh, it's because we've had a bit of rain and that, there's a few things have got a bit of a spurt on, and are doing pretty well, which we need to knock over today.
We've got a group of people from all over the shop here today, but you're the only oyster farmer that's come along on today's trip. So what is it that motivates you in particular to get involved with this project?
Well, the reason why I'm probably the only one here is there's not many of us left. We got wiped out by a virus called POMS in January 2013. We were really getting on track about rebuilding ourselves after getting wiped out by a parasite called QX in 2004, working out in the river. That's, you know, it's my whole life, really. I mean, I don't want to spend the rest of my life, you know, driving a truck or anything like that. I mean, I want to work out in the river, and I'll try hard to stay there. But, you know, people often say you must have some terrible days out in the river, you know, and I say, no, well, you don't really. I always say I'd rather be going underneath the M1 than over the top of it. The water is really, it's the lowest point of the bush, and everything which goes on in the catchment area in the bush eventually ends up in the water. So we can't just look after the water, we've got to look after catchment area and the bush, and because, I mean, it all ends up in the river when it rains. My livelihood as an oyster farmer depends on the water quality, and that's the single biggest issue. Oysters are filter feeders, and if you haven't got water quality, you know, you can't grow oysters. If you haven't got a healthy oyster industry, you don't have a healthy river, and if you haven't got a healthy river, you haven't got a healthy catchment area. When you sort of hear, instead of being out there running around on the oyster leases, you get a lot different perspective as well. When we're out in the oyster leases, you don't get much of a chance to go out in the bush, and it's just a whole different, you know, you're sitting here looking out instead of out there looking in, and you can see the problems, you know, of these invasive weeds and that more easily, and good to know that you're trying to help do something about them anyway. And we've got the tools and we've got the knowledge with the tides and that to make it a bit easier for them. And so, you know, why wouldn't you do it?
Stephen!
You're listening to Off Track on RN. I'm Anne Jones, and we're on the edge of the Hawkesbury River at the Mugamara Nature Reserve. The reserve is rarely open to the public, and the part we're in is only accessible by boat. We're at a place where a house used to be. You can see some of the retaining walls around, and there are bits and pieces of iron rusting away through the area. But it's long been abandoned. The house is gone. If it weren't for all the weeds, you might never know it was even there. The weeds are almost all common garden plants which have been left behind, and they've colonised the area. When you jump off the boat, you see a wall of plants. It seems like none of them are native. And the volunteers are champing at the bit to get weeding, but instead, they're told to tramp further up the hill into the bush and weed up there, where there are fewer invasive species. Why is that? Rebecca Moy works with the Greater Sydney Local Land Services, and she organises the floating land care.
Well, basic bush regen principles is to work from the good bush to the bad. So what we want to do is try and save the area where the bush is coming back really well and just go and get the small isolated pockets of weeds. And then we want to move to the worse areas and try and extend the zone of natives back into where the weeds were. So that's why instead of going to where we could see initially, like hopping off the boat and just pulling out Biden, we want to go back up into the area where we've previously done works and concentrate all our energy on the better areas and make sure that we can get rid of the weeds out of there.
Tim Lever works for a private bush regeneration company called Waratah Ego Works, and he's employed to help teach the volunteers how to identify and deal with specific weeds.
The weed I've just been pulling out here is called Madeira vine, and that's a real beauty. It can be quite smothering. It can cover up natives quite extensively, but it also has lots of little tubers that grow from every node or every bud on the plant. So as soon as you pull on the vine, those little guys fall off into the soil and then they grow again, and there's absolutely thousands of them on a mature plant. So it's a really difficult one to control, and it's one of those weeds that you just need to keep at it and do a lot of follow-up weeding with it.
Now, is that what I can see here, where it's literally curled and curled and curled around a blade of grass?
Yep, that's it. So as you can see, it really kind of strangles everything that it gets on.
You look like you're getting there, though. There's a few bits hanging around. How long do you reckon it's going to take you to move through this patch?
Well, probably, you know, a good 15 minutes on this little bit here. But what this kind of plant needs is follow-up. So you'd really need to come back, you know, every few weeks and see what's coming back to make sure you get all the plant.
There's a bit of Lord of the Jungle happening here as well, because it is actually wrapping itself around a lantana.
That's right. It's a battle of the weeds here, isn't it? these disturbed sites, it's old disturbance, so there's probably been a house here built 100 years ago. And, you know, weeds are quite opportunistic, so on those disturbed sites they really take hold. And as you can see here, we've got all the big names in the weeds. We've got lantana, we've got Madeira, we've got senna. So they're nearly competing with each other.
So we pick our fleeting land care sites because they're sort of outbreaks of disturbance, rather than going to a site where we know that possibly it could take years for it to come back. So we've selected a site where there is still some weed issues, but there's some good canopy, there is some natives on the ground that can get their feet in and get a bit bigger, but they just need a little bit more space.
Well, let's talk about giving them some space. We've got some lantana here. What can you tell me about that?
So lantana is one of the eco-transforming type of weeds. It can take over quite quickly. Normally, in a sort of rural area, lantana can go along fence lines because the birds will generally eat the berries and then they'll drop the seeds and then the lantana spreads that way. It grows in thickets generally, so on this site there was a huge amount of lantana and they have managed to get rid of quite a bit of it, but there's still a few outcrops, so it's really important to go back over a site and do a little bit of maintenance and try and get rid of the ones that have come up.
So it's quite sort of vigorous growing, isn't it? It seems to never say die.
Yeah. So lantana, it's got the yellow-pink flowers on it, and it is a really hard thing to tackle when you first look at it, but you've got to take weed projects one step at a time. So with a particular plant such as lantana, it's good to try and knock it back at the right time of year.
The volunteers have been instructed to lop them off quite close to the ground, and then to dab a bit of poison on it within 20 seconds. So what's with the time limit?
Well, what happens with a lantana, once you've cut it, it can, and the base is exposed to the air, it'll quickly shut off. So if you don't get to it quick enough to put the poison in, it won't be able to take the poison down to its roots. So that's why it's really important to get to it as fast as you can. You can't really go and tackle a whole heap of cutting and then come back a couple of hours later, because it won't work. You'll just end up with it re-sprouting from the base. So that's why you've got to try and get to it quite quickly.
Rebecca Moy. On the last trip to this site, the volunteers removed a huge amount of invasive weeds. They had to take them all the way back on the boat and then dispose of them. It took a lot of energy. This time, Tegan Burton from the New South Wales Parks and Wildlife Service is taking a different tact. She's got a huge roll of black plastic and she's laying sections out on the ground, weighing them down with rocks.
What we've decided to do with some of the weeds here is actually keep them on site and compost them on site. So rather than, because we're working in a quite remote area, we don't really want to have to bag everything up and then take it off site and then dispose of somewhere. And so instead we keep it on site but try to get it to break down. So we put black plastic down on the ground to separate it from the soil and becoming seeds in the soil. And then we, once there's a big pile, we'll put another sheet of black plastic over the top and that'll help it just compost on site.
How long do you think it'd take? Because you've rolled out, it's probably 3 metres wide, 3 metres long by 2 metres wide. You've rolled out a big piece of black plastic. How long do you think it'll take for it to all sort of go down into soily goodness?
Yeah, to be completely honest, I'm not sure. The plastic's expected to last about 3 or 4 years, and I would certainly expect it to be composted maybe within 6 months. What often happens, depending on the site, is that if it's a site that you come regularly, is you just keep adding new material to it, and so you don't really have a clear time frame. Here, we tend to only come here every 6 to 12 months, or maybe 2 years, depending on what the priorities are. So, yeah, by the next visit, you'd expect it to be quite composted.
What's different about this group than any other land care project?
Well, I think Floating Land Care's given a lot of people opportunities to come out onto the river and have a look at what different sites look like on the river. Some of them are bush care volunteers at their own local bush care site. So they'll go to those bush care sites really regularly. They can see progress over time, and they're all working towards a common goal. But with Floating Land Care, it gives them an opportunity to come out and meet people potentially from other bush care groups. They share their own stories. So they'll meet each other, and then they'll all work towards a common goal at one particular site that we're going to visit on that day. So quite a few of the volunteers are regulars to Floating Land Care, so they've seen heaps of the sites along the river. Usually we're in national parks, so they're trying to make a difference to a really good condition site and trying to get it even better. So it might be different to a local suburban one where they could be totally overrun with weeds for years and years, but here they've got an opportunity to try and make a difference over just a couple of visits.
I really like coming out with the volunteers, because most of them are a little bit older, and it really is encouraging to see people, putting their time in to come out and you get new people and you get the same people back, and you build up a bit of relationship and it's not just pulling out weeds, and it's a social thing for them. There's no way in the world I'd stop doing it. I think it's great.
They've got lots of time to have a chat during this kind of activity. So we stop for morning tea and we have also a nice lunch. You get time to meet new people while you're on the boat going backwards and forwards, and they also have a chance to sort of have a chat while they're doing the weeds as well. So it depends. If you like working in a small group, it can be good for those type of people, and if they just like working individually, they can just meet new people as they're on the boat or at morning tea, but then spend some time on their own pulling out weeds, not too far from the rest of the group, of course. But you know, you don't have to be in each other's pockets for the whole time you're on this activity. It's totally up to you what you choose to do. I think, yeah, that the volunteers do enjoy it. I've had a lot of feedback over all of the activities that we've done. They tell me about what they'd like to do next, or where they'd like to go, what they'd like to have for the lunch next time, or that we've had great Tim Tams this time. So it is a fun experience, and the feedback's always been really good.
The volunteers did all seem very merry and pleased with their morning tea and lunch too. Therese Haywood is involved in all sorts of bush regeneration activities, and I asked her what she got out of all of it.
Part of it is the enjoyment of being in a group of people working together, and also the fact that you can do this from, you know, maybe your teens all the way through to your 90s, as long as you have a fair amount of mobility and you are able to take a little bit of muscular work, then you can keep doing this your whole life. So that's the lovely part of it. And also Australia is one of the countries that pioneered this style of bush regeneration, where we work from the good to the bad. So it came from the Bradley sisters in the 70s and 80s, and it just reached out and out and out to now like Land Care and Greening Australia groups, and lots of councils have volunteers. So we've all taught each other this methodology of working. So, and the Bradley sisters, they were quite old when they started. Like, they were already over the age of 60. So that's why it has attracted people who are age 40 plus.
How do you think you'll feel when you get home, the Savo?
Well, I'll be trying to show my family the photos I took today. I actually have already Facebooked 27 photos at morning tea, so my other friends who didn't come today can see what we did. And you do really remember the landscape, the eucalypts, the sandstone cliffs, the Hawkesbury River, the mangroves. It does stay with you, and it's pretty amazing.
I suppose you wouldn't think that a day of weeding would be relaxing, but it seems that it was, because as all of the volunteers piled back onto the boat, they all gazed out into the distance at the view, as if in a zen-like state. A mixture of hard work and fresh air and good company seemed to do them wonders. You might have heard, in the recent federal budget, about the cuts to land care. Well, those cuts don't directly affect the floating land care we've heard about today, It's funded through the New South Wales Government's Environmental Trust, but only up until August 2014. After that, the future is uncertain. Thank you to Therese Haywood, Tim Lever, Rebecca Moy, Tegan Burton, Rob Moxham, and all the volunteers for making me welcome out at Milson's Passage. You can, of course, find photos of the activities over at the Off Track website at abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to the Off Track program page. That's the sound of the oyster punt pushing up onto the beach back at the meeting point, by the way, signalling the end of the day and the dispersal of the Landcare volunteer team too. I hope you've enjoyed this quick trip up the Hawkesbury on today's program. I'm Anne Jones, and next week on Off Track, I'll take you somewhere else.